Disc 21.
Lydgate uttered this speech in the curt, hammering way with which we usually try to nail down a vague mind to imperative facts. Tears rolled silently down Rosamond's cheeks. She just pressed her handkerchief against them and stood looking at the large vase on the mantelpiece. It was a moment of more intense bitterness than she had ever felt before. At last, she said without hurry, and with careful emphasis,
"I could never have believed that you would like to act in that way."
"Like it!" burst out Lydgate, rising from his chair, thrusting his hands in his pocket, and stalking away from the hearth. "It's not a question of liking. Of course I don't like it. It's the only thing I can do." He wheeled round there and turned towards her.
"I should have thought there were many other means than that," said Rosamond. "Let us have a sail and leave Middlemarch altogether."
"To do what? What is the use of my leaving my work in Middlemarch to go where I have none? We should be just as penniless elsewhere as we are here," said Lydgate, still more angrily.
"If we are to be in that position, it will be entirely your own doing, Tertius," said Rosamond, turning round to speak with the fullest conviction. "You will not behave as you ought to do to your own family. You offended Captain Lydgate. Sir Godwin was very kind to me when we were at Qualingham, and I am sure if you showed proper regard to him and told him your affairs, he would do anything for you. But rather than that, you like giving up our house and furniture to Mr. Ned Plimdale."
There was something like fierceness in Lydgate's eyes as he answered with new violence.
"Well, then, if you will have it so, I do like it. I admit that I like it better than making a fool of myself by going to beg where it's of no use. Understand, then, that is what I like to do."
There was a tone in the last sentence which was equivalent to the clutch of his strong hand on Rosamond's delicate arm. But for all that, his will was not a whit stronger than hers. She immediately walked out of the room in silence, but with an intense determination to hinder what Lydgate liked to do. He went out of the house, but as his blood cooled, he felt that the chief result of the discussion was a deposit of dread within him at the idea of opening with his wife in future subjects which might again urge him to violent speech. It was as if a fracture in delicate crystal had begun, and he was afraid of any movement that might make it fatal. His marriage would be a mere piece of bitter irony if they could not go on loving each other. He had long ago made up his mind to what he thought was her negative character, her want of sensibility, which showed itself in disregard both of his specific wishes and of his general aims. The first great disappointment had been borne. The tender devotedness and docile adoration of the ideal wife must be renounced, and life must be taken up on a lower stage of expectation, as it is by men who have lost their limbs. But the real wife had not only her claims, she had still a hold on his heart, and it was his intense desire that the hold should remain strong. In marriage, the certainty, "She will never love me much," is easier to bear than the fear, "I shall love her no more." Hence, after that outburst, his inward effort was entirely to excuse her, and to blame the hard circumstances which were partly his fault. He tried that evening by petting her to heal the wound he had made in the morning, and it was not in Rosamond's nature to be repellent or sulky. Indeed, she welcomed the signs that her husband loved her and was under control. But this was something quite distinct from loving him. Lydgate would not have chosen soon to recur to the plan of parting with the house. He was resolved to carry it out, and say as little more about it as possible. But Rosamond herself touched on it at breakfast by saying mildly,
"Have you spoken to Trumbull yet?"
"No," said Lydgate, "but I shall call on him as I go by this morning. No time must be lost." He took Rosamond's question as a sign that she withdrew her inward opposition, and kissed her head caressingly when he got up to go away. As soon as it was late enough to make a call, Rosamond went to Mrs. Plimdale, Mr. Ned's mother, and entered with pretty congratulations into the subject of the coming marriage. Mrs. Plimdale's maternal view was that Rosamond might possibly now have retrospective glimpses of her own folly, and feeling the advantages to be at present all on the side of her son, was too kind a woman not to behave graciously.
"Yes, Ned is most happy, I must say, and Sophie Toller is all I could desire in a daughter-in-law. Of course, her father is able to do something handsome for her. That is only what would be expected with a brewery like his, and the connection is everything we should desire. But that is not what I look at. She is a very nice girl. No airs, no pretensions, though on a level with the first. I don't mean with the titled aristocracy. I see very little good in people aiming out of their own sphere. I mean that Sophie is equal to the best in the town, and she is contented with that."
"I have always thought her very agreeable," said Rosamond. "I look upon it as a reward for Ned, who never held his head too high, that he should have got into the very best connection," continued Mrs. Plimdale, her native sharpness softened by a fervid sense that she was taking a correct view. "And such particular people as the Tollers are, they might have objected because some of our friends are not theirs. It is well known that your aunt Bulstrode and I have been intimate from our youth, and Mr. Plimdale has always been on Mr. Bulstrode's side. And I myself prefer serious opinions. But the Tollers have welcomed Ned all the same."
"I am sure he is a very deserving, well-principled young man," said Rosamond with a neat air of patronage, in return for Mrs. Plimdale's wholesome corrections.
"Oh, he has not the style of a captain in the army, or that sort of carriage as if everybody was beneath him, or that showy kind of talking and singing and intellectual talent. But I am thankful he has not. It is a poor preparation both for here and hereafter."
"Oh, dear, yes. Appearances have very little to do with happiness," said Rosamond. "I think there is every prospect of their being a happy couple. What house will they take?"
"Oh, as for that, they must put up with what they can get. They have been looking at the house in St. Peter's Place next to Mr. Hackbutt's. It belongs to him, and he is putting it nicely in repair. I suppose they are not likely to hear of a better. Indeed, I think Ned will decide the matter today."
"I should think it is a nice house. I like St. Peter's Place."
"Well, it is near the church, and a genteel situation. But the windows are narrow, and it is all ups and downs. You don't happen to know of any other that would be at liberty?" said Mrs. Plimdale, fixing her round black eyes on Rosamond, with the animation of a sudden thought in them.
"Oh, no. I hear so little of those things."
Rosamond had not foreseen that question and answer in setting out to pay her visit. She had simply meant to gather any information which would help her to avert the parting with her own house under circumstances thoroughly disagreeable to her. As to the untruth in her reply, she no more reflected on it than she did on the untruth there was in her saying that appearances had very little to do with happiness. Her object, she was convinced, was thoroughly justifiable. It was Lydgate whose intention was inexcusable, and there was a plan in her mind which, when she had carried it out fully, would prove how very false a step it would have been for him to have descended from his position. She returned home by Mr. Borthrop Trumbull's office, meaning to call there. It was the first time in her life that Rosamond had thought of doing anything in the form of business, but she felt equal to the occasion. That she should be obliged to do what she intensely disliked was an idea which turned her quiet tenacity into active invention. Here was a case in which it could not be enough simply to disobey and be serenely, placidly obstinate. She must act according to her judgment, and she said to herself that her judgment was right. Indeed, if it had not been, she would not have wished to act on it. Mr. Trumbull was in the back room of his office, and received Rosamond with his finest manners, not only because he had much sensibility to her charms, but because the good-natured fibre in him was stirred by his certainty that Lydgate was in difficulties, and that this uncommonly pretty woman, this young lady with the highest personal attractions, was likely to feel the pinch of trouble, to find herself involved in circumstances beyond her control. He begged her to do him the honour to take a seat, and stood before her, trimming and comporting himself with an eager solicitude which was chiefly benevolent. Rosamond's first question was whether her husband had called on Mr. Trumbull that morning to speak about disposing of their house.
"Yes, ma'am, yes, he did. He did so," said the good auctioneer, trying to throw something soothing into his iteration. I was about to fulfil his order, if possible, this afternoon. He wished me not to procrastinate.
I called to tell you not to go any further, Mr. Trumbull, and I beg of you not to mention what has been said on the subject. Will you oblige me?
Certainly I will, Mrs. Lydgate, certainly. Confidence is sacred with me on business or any other topic. I am then to consider the commission withdrawn, said Mr. Trumbull, adjusting the long ends of his blue cravat with both hands and looking at Rosamond deferentially.
Yes, if you please. I find that Mr. Ned Plimdale has taken a house, the one in St. Peter's Place, next to Mr. Hackbutt's. Mr. Lydgate would be annoyed that his orders should be fulfilled uselessly. And besides that, there are other circumstances which render the proposal unnecessary.
Very good, Mrs. Lydgate, very good. I am at your commands whenever you require any service of me, said Mr. Trumbull, who felt pleasure in conjecturing that some new resources had been opened. Rely on me, I beg. The affair shall go no further.
That evening Lydgate was a little comforted by observing that Rosamond was more lively than she had usually been of late, and even seemed interested in doing what would please him without being asked. He thought, if she will be happy and I can rub through, what does it all signify? It is only a narrow swamp that we have to pass in a long journey. If I can get my mind clear again, I shall do.
He was so much cheered that he began to search for an account of experiments which he had long ago meant to look up and had neglected, out of that creeping self-despair which comes in the train of petty anxieties. He felt again some of the old delightful absorption in a far-reaching inquiry, while Rosamond played the quiet music which was as helpful to his meditation as the plash of an oar on the evening lake. It was rather late. He had pushed away all the books and was looking at the fire with his hands clasped behind his head, in forgetfulness of everything except the construction of a new controlling experiment. When Rosamond, who had left the piano and was leaning back in her chair watching him, said,
"Mr. Ned Plimdale has taken a house already."
Lydgate, startled and jarred, looked up in silence for a moment, like a man who has been disturbed in his sleep. Then, flushing with an unpleasant consciousness, he asked, "How do you know?"
"I called at Mrs. Plimdale's this morning, and she told me that he had taken the house in St. Peter's Place next to Mr. Hackbutt's."
Lydgate was silent. He drew his hands from behind his head and pressed them against the hair, which was hanging, as it was apt to do, in a mass on his forehead, while he rested his elbow on his knees. He was feeling bitter disappointment, as if he had opened a door out of a suffocating place and had found it walled up. But he also felt sure that Rosamond was pleased with the cause of his disappointment. He preferred not looking at her and not speaking until he had got over the first spasm of vexation. "After all," he said in his bitterness, "what can a woman care about so much as house and furniture? A husband without them is an absurdity." When he looked up and pushed his hair aside, his dark eyes had a miserable, blank non-expectance of sympathy in them. But he only said coolly, "Perhaps someone else may turn up. I told Trumbull to be on the lookout if he failed with Plimdale." Rosamond made no remark. She trusted to the chance that nothing more would pass between her husband and the auctioneer until some issue should have justified her interference. At any rate, she had hindered the event which she immediately dreaded. After a pause, she said,
"How much money is it that those disagreeable people want?"
"What disagreeable people?"
"Those who took the list, and the others. I mean, how much money would satisfy them so that you need not be troubled any more?"
Lydgate surveyed her for a moment, as if he were looking for symptoms, and then said, "Oh, if I could have got 600 from Plimdale for furniture and as premium, I might have managed. I could have paid off Dover and given enough on account to the others to make them wait patiently, if we contracted our expenses."
"But I mean, how much should you want if we stayed in this house?"
"More than I am likely to get anywhere," said Lydgate, with rather a grating sarcasm in his tone. It angered him to perceive that Rosamond's mind was wandering over impracticable wishes instead of facing possible efforts.
"Why should you not mention the sum?"
said Rosamond, with a mild indication that she did not like his manners. "Well," said Lydgate in a guessing tone, It would take at least 1,000 to set me at ease. But, he added incisively, I have to consider what I shall do without it, not with it.
Rosamond said no more. But the next day, she carried out her plan of writing to Sir Godwin Lydgate. Since the captain's visit, she had received a letter from him, and also one from Mrs. Mengan, his married sister, condoling with her on the loss of her baby, and expressing vaguely the hope that they should see her again at Qualingham. Lydgate had told her that this politeness meant nothing, but she was secretly convinced that any backwardness in Lydgate's family towards him was due to his cold and contemptuous behaviour, and she answered the letters in her most charming manner, feeling some confidence that a specific invitation would follow. But there had been total silence. The captain evidently was not a great penman, and Rosamond reflected that the sisters might have been abroad. However, the season was come for thinking of friends at home, and at any rate Sir Godwin, who had chucked her under the chin and pronounced her to be like the celebrated beauty Mrs. Crowley, who had made a conquest of him in 1790, would be touched by any appeal from her, and would find it pleasant for her sake to behave as he ought to do towards his nephew. Rosamond was naively convinced of what an old gentleman ought to do to prevent her from suffering annoyance, and she wrote what she considered the most judicious letter possible, one which would strike Sir Godwin as a proof of her excellent sense, pointing out how desirable it was that Tertius should quit such a place as Middlemarch for one more fitted to his talents, how the unpleasant character of the inhabitants had hindered his professional success, and how, in consequence, he was in money difficulties, from which it would require 1,000 pounds thoroughly to extricate him. She did not say that Tertius was unaware of her intention to write, for she had the idea that his supposed sanction of her letter would be in accordance with what she did say of his great regard for his uncle Godwin as the relative who had always been his best friend. Such was the force of poor Rosamond's tactics, now she applied them to affairs. This had happened before the party on New Year's Day, and no answer had yet come from Sir Godwin. But on the morning of that day, Lydgate had to learn that Rosamond had revoked his order to Borthrop Trumbull. Feeling it necessary that she should be gradually accustomed to the idea of their quitting the house in Lowick Gate, he overcame his reluctance to speak to her again on the subject, and when they were breakfasting said, "I shall try to see Trumbull this morning and tell him to advertise the house in the Pioneer and the Trumpet. If the thing were advertised, someone might be inclined to take it, who would not otherwise have thought of a change. In these country places, many people go on in their old houses when their families are too large for them, for want of knowing where they can find another. And Trumbull seems to have got no bite at all." Rosamond knew that the inevitable moment was come.
"I ordered Trumbull not to inquire further," she said, with a careful calmness which was evidently defensive.
Lydgate stared at her in mute amazement. Only half an hour before, he had been fastening up her plaits for her, and talking the little language of affection, which Rosamond, though not returning it, accepted as if she had been a serene and lovely image, now and then miraculously dimpling towards her votary. With such fibres still astir in him, the shock he received could not at once be distinctly anger. It was confused pain. He laid down the knife and fork with which he was carving, and throwing himself back in his chair, said at last, with a cool irony in his tone, "May I ask when and why you did so?"
"When I knew that the Plimdales had taken a house, I called to tell him not to mention ours to them, and at the same time I told him not to let the affair go on any further. I knew that it would be very injurious to you if it were known that you wished to part with your house and furniture, and I had a very strong objection to it. I think that was reason enough."
"It was of no consequence, then, that I had told you imperative reasons of another kind? Of no consequence that I had come to a different conclusion and given an order accordingly?" said Lydgate, bitingly, the thunder and lightning gathering about his brow and eyes. The effect of anyone's anger on Rosamond had always been to make her shrink in cold dislike, and to become all the more calmly correct, in the conviction that she was not the person to misbehave, whatever others might do. She replied,
"I think I had a perfect right to speak on a subject which concerns me at least as much as you."
"Clearly you had a right to speak, but only to me. "You had no right to contradict my orders secretly and treat me as if I were a fool," said Lydgate, in the same tone as before. Then, with some added scorn, "Is it possible to make you understand what the consequences will be? Is it of any use for me to tell you again why we must try to part with the house?"
"It is not necessary for you to tell me again," said Rosamond, in a voice that fell and trickled like cold water drops. "I remembered what you said. You spoke just as violently as you do now. But that does not alter my opinion that you ought to try every other means rather than take a step which is so painful to me. And as to advertising the house, I think it would be perfectly degrading to you."
"And suppose I disregard your opinion as you disregard mine?"
"You can do so, of course. But I think you ought to have told me before we were married that you would place me in the worst position rather than give up your own will."
Lydgate did not speak, but tossed his head on one side and twitched the corners of his mouth in despair. Rosamond, seeing that he was not looking at her, rose and set his cup of coffee before him. But he took no notice of it, and went on with an inward drama and argument, occasionally moving in his seat, resting one arm on the table, and rubbing his hand against his hair. There was a conflux of emotions and thoughts in him that would not let him either give thorough way to his anger, or persevere with simple rigidity of resolve. Rosamond took advantage of his silence.
"When we were married, everyone felt that your position was very high. I could not have imagined then that you would want to sell our furniture and take a house in Bride Street where the rooms are like cages. If we are to live in that way, let us at least leave Middlemarch."
"These would be very strong considerations," said Lydgate, half ironically. Still there was a withered paleness about his lips as he looked at his coffee and did not drink. "These would be very strong considerations if I did not happen to be in debt."
"Many persons must have been in debt in the same way. But if they are respectable, people trust them. I am sure I have heard Papa say that the Torbits were in debt, and they went on very well." "It cannot be good to act rashly," said Rosamond, with serene wisdom.
Lydgate sat paralysed by opposing impulses. Since no reasoning he could apply to Rosamond seemed likely to conquer her assent, he wanted to smash and grind some object on which he could at least produce an impression, or else to tell her brutally that he was master and she must obey. But he not only dreaded the effect of such extremities on their mutual life, he had a growing dread of Rosamond's quiet, elusive obstinacy, which would not allow any assertion of power to be final. And again, she had touched him in a spot of keenest feeling, by implying that she had been deluded with a false vision of happiness in marrying him. As to saying that he was master, it was not the fact. The very resolution to which he had wrought himself by dint of logic and honourable pride was beginning to relax under her torpedo contact. He swallowed half his cup of coffee and then rose to go.
"I may at least request that you will not go to Trumbull at present, until it has been seen that there are no other means," said Rosamond.
Although she was not subject to much fear, she felt it safer not to betray that she had written to Sir Godwin.
"Promise me that you will not go to him for a few weeks, or without telling me."
Lydgate gave a short laugh.
"I think it is I who should exact a promise that you will do nothing without telling me," he said, turning his eyes sharply upon her and then moving to the door.
"You remember that we are going to dine at Papa's," said Rosamond,
wishing that he should turn and make a more thorough concession to her. But he only said, "Oh, yes," impatiently, and went away. She held it to be very odious in him that he did not think the painful propositions he had had to make to her were enough, without showing so unpleasant a temper. And when she put the moderate request that he would defer going to Trumbull again, it was cruel in him not to assure her of what he meant to do. She was convinced of her having acted in every way for the best, and each grating or angry speech of Lydgate's served only as an addition to the register of offences in her mind. Poor Rosamond for months had begun to associate her husband with feelings of disappointment, and the terribly inflexible relation of marriage had lost its charm of encouraging delightful dreams.
It had freed her from the disagreeables of her father's house, but it had not given her everything that she had wished and hoped. The Lydgate with whom she had been in love had been a group of airy conditions for her, most of which had disappeared, while their place had been taken by everyday details which must be lived through slowly from hour to hour, not floated through with a rapid selection of favourable aspects. The habits of Lydgate's profession, his home preoccupation with scientific subjects, which seemed to her almost like a morbid vampire's taste, his peculiar views of things which had never entered into the dialogue of courtship, all these continually alienating influences, even without the fact of his having placed himself at a disadvantage in the town, and without that first shock of revelation about Dover's debt, would have made his presence dull to her. There was another presence which, ever since the early days of her marriage until 4 months ago, had been an agreeable excitement, but that was gone. Rosamond would not confess to herself how much the consequent blank had to do with her utter ennui. And it seemed to her, perhaps she was right, that an invitation to Quallingham and an opening for Lydgate to settle elsewhere than in Middlemarch, in London, or somewhere likely to be free from unpleasantness, would satisfy her quite well, and make her indifferent to the absence of Will Ladislaw, towards whom she felt some resentment for his exaltation of Mrs. Casaubon. That was the state of things with Lydgate and Rosamond on the New Year's Day when they dined at her father's, she looking mildly neutral towards him in remembrance of his ill-tempered behaviour at breakfast, and he carrying a much deeper effect from the inward conflict in which that morning scene was only one of many epochs. His flushed effort while talking to Mr. Fairbrother, his effort after the cynical pretense that all ways of getting money are essentially the same, and that chance has an empire which reduces choice to a fool's illusion, was but the symptom of a wavering resolve, a benumbed response to the old stimuli of enthusiasm. What was he to do? He saw even more keenly than Rosamond did the dreariness of taking her into the small house in Bride Street, where she would have scanty furniture around her and discontent within. A life of privation and life with Rosamond were two images which had become more and more irreconcilable, ever since the threat of privation had disclosed itself. But even if his resolves had forced the two images into combination, the useful preliminaries to that hard change were not visibly within reach, and though he had not given the promise which his wife had asked for, he did not go again to Trumbull. He even began to think of taking a rapid journey to the north and seeing Sir Godwin. He had once believed that nothing would urge him into making an application for money to his uncle, but he had not then known the full pressure of alternatives yet more disagreeable. He could not depend on the effect of a letter. It was only in an interview, however disagreeable this might be to himself, that he could give a thorough explanation and could test the effectiveness of kinship. No sooner had Lydgate begun to represent this step to himself as the easiest than there was a reaction of anger that he who had long ago determined to live aloof from such abject calculations, such self-interested anxiety about the inclinations and the pockets of men with whom he had been proud to have no aims in common, should have fallen not simply to their level, but to the level of soliciting them. Chapter 65. The bias of human nature to be slow in correspondence triumphs even over the present quickening in the general pace of things. What wonder, then, that in 1832... old Sir Godwin Lydgate was slow to write a letter which was of consequence to others rather than to himself. Nearly 3 weeks of the new year were gone, and Rosamond, awaiting an answer to her winning appeal, was every day disappointed. Lydgate, in total ignorance of her expectations, was seeing the bills come in, and feeling that Dover's use of his advantage over other creditors was imminent. He had never mentioned to Rosamond his brooding purpose of going to Quallingham. He did not want to admit what would appear to her a concession to her wishes after indignant refusal until the last moment, but he was really expecting to set off soon. A slice of the railway would enable him to manage the whole journey and back in 4 days. But one morning after Lydgate had gone out, a letter came addressed to him which Rosamond saw clearly to be from Sir Godwin. She was full of hope. Perhaps there might be a particular note to her enclosed. But Lydgate was naturally addressed on the question of money or other aid, and the fact that he was written to, nay, The very delay in writing at all seemed to certify that the answer was thoroughly compliant. She was too much excited by these thoughts to do anything but light stitching in a warm corner of the dining room, with the outside of this momentous letter lying on the table before her. About 12, she heard her husband's step in the passage, and tripping to open the door, she said in her lightest tones,
"Tertius, come in here. Here is a letter for you."
"Ah?" he said, not taking off his hat, but just turning her round within his arm to walk towards the spot where the letter lay. "My Uncle Godwin!" he exclaimed, while Rosamond reseated herself and watched him as he opened the letter. She had expected him to be surprised. While Lydgate's eyes glanced rapidly over the brief letter, she saw his face, usually of a pale brown, taking on a dry whiteness, with nostrils and lips quivering. He tossed down the letter before her and said violently, "It will be impossible to endure life with you if you will be always acting secretly, acting in opposition to me and hiding your actions." He checked his speech and turned his back on her, then wheeled round and walked about, sat down and got up again restlessly, grasping hard objects deep down in his pockets. He was afraid of saying something irremediably cruel. Rosamond, too, had changed colour as she read. The letter ran this way. "Dear Tertius, don't set your wife to write to me when you have anything to ask. It is a roundabout, wheedling sort of thing which I should not have credited you with. I never choose to write to a woman on matters of business. As to my supplying you with £1,000, or only half that sum, I can do nothing of the sort. My own family drains me to the last penny. With 2 younger sons and 3 daughters, I am not likely to have cash to spare. You seem to have got through your own money pretty quickly, and to have made a mess where you are. The sooner you go somewhere else, the better. But I have nothing to do with men of your profession, and can't help you there. I did the best I could for you as guardian, and let you have your own way in taking to medicine. You might have gone into the army or the church. Your money would have held out for that, and there would have been a surer ladder before you. Your Uncle Charles has had a grudge against you for not going into his profession, but not I. I have always wished you well. But you must consider yourself on your own legs entirely now. Your affectionate uncle, Godwin Lydgate." When Rosamond had finished reading the letter, she sat quite still, with her hands folded before her, restraining any show of her keen disappointment, and entrenching herself in quiet passivity under her husband's wrath. Lydgate paused in his movements, looked at her again, and said with biting severity, "Will this be enough to convince you of the harm you may do by secret meddling? Have you sense enough to recognise now your incompetence to judge and act for me, to interfere with your ignorance in affairs which it belongs to me to decide on?" The words were hard, but this was not the first time that Lydgate had been frustrated by her. She did not look at him, and made no reply. "I had nearly resolved on going to Qualingham. It would have cost me pain enough to do it, yet it might have been of some use. But it has been of no use for me to think of anything. You have always been counteracting me secretly. You delude me with a false assent, and then I am at the mercy of your devices. If you mean to resist every wish I express, say so and defy me. I shall at least know what I am doing then." It is a terrible moment in young lives when the closeness of love's bond has turned to this power of galling. In spite of Rosamond's self-control, a tear fell silently and rolled over her lips. She still said nothing, but under that quietude was hidden an intense effect. She was in such entire disgust with her husband that she wished that she had never seen him. Sir Godwin's rudeness towards her and utter want of feeling ranged him with Dover and all other creditors, disagreeable people who only thought of themselves and did not mind how annoying they were to her. Even her father was unkind and might have done more for them. In fact, there was but one person in Rosamond's world whom she did not regard as blameworthy, and that was the graceful creature with blonde plaits and with little hands crossed before her, who had never expressed herself unbecomingly and had always acted for the best. The best, naturally, being what she best liked. Lydgate, pausing and looking at her again, began to feel that half-maddening sense of helplessness which comes over passionate people when their passion is met by an innocent-looking silence, whose meek, victimized air seems to put them in the wrong, and at last infects even the justest indignation with a doubt of its justice. He needed to recover the full sense that he was in the right. by moderating his words. "Can you not see, Rosamond?" he began again, trying to be simply grave and not bitter. "That nothing can be so fatal as a want of openness and confidence between us. It has happened again and again that I have expressed a decided wish, and you have seemed to assent, yet after that you have secretly disobeyed my wish. In that way I can never know what I have to trust to. There would be some hope for us if you would admit this. Am I such an unreasonable, furious brute? Why should you not be open with me?" Still silence. "Will you only say that you have been mistaken, and that I may depend on your not acting secretly in future?" said Lydgate, urgently but with something of request in his tone, which Rosamond was quick to perceive. She spoke with coolness.
"I cannot possibly make admissions or promises in answer to such words as you have used towards me. I have not been accustomed to language of that kind. You have spoken of my secret meddling, and my interfering ignorance, and my false assent. I have never expressed myself in that way to you, and I think that you ought to apologize. You spoke of its being impossible to live with me. Certainly you have not made my life pleasant to me of late. I think it was to be expected that I should try to avert some of the hardships which our marriage has brought on me."
Another tear fell as Rosamond ceased speaking, and she pressed it away as quietly as the first. Lydgate flung himself into a chair, feeling checkmated. What place was there in her mind for a remonstrance to lodge in? He laid down his hat, flung an arm over the back of his chair, and looked down for some moments without speaking. Rosamond had the double purchase over him, of insensibility to the point of justice in his reproach, and of sensibility to the undeniable hardships now present in her married life. Although her duplicity in the affair of the house had exceeded what he knew, and had really hindered the Plimdales from knowing of it, she had no consciousness that her action could rightly be called false. We are not obliged to identify our own acts according to a strict classification, any more than the materials of our grocery and clothes. Rosamond felt that she was aggrieved, and that this was what Lydgate had to recognize. As for him, the need of accommodating himself to her nature, which was inflexible in proportion to its negations, held him as with pincers. He had begun to have an alarmed foresight of her irrevocable loss of love for him, and the consequent dreariness of their life. The ready fullness of his emotions made this dread alternate quickly with the first violent movements of his anger. It would assuredly have been a vain boast in him to say that he was her master. "You have not made my life pleasant to me of late. The hardships which our marriage has brought on me." These words were stinging his imagination as a pain makes an exaggerated dream. If he were not only to sink from his highest resolve, but to sink into the hideous fettering of domestic hate. "Rosamond," he said, turning his eyes on her with a melancholy look, "you should allow for a man's words when he is disappointed and provoked. You and I cannot have opposite interests. I cannot part my happiness from yours. If I am angry with you, it is that you seem not to see how any concealment divides us. How could I wish to make anything hard to you, either by my words or conduct? When I hurt you, I hurt part of my own life. I should never be angry with you if you would be quite open with me."
"I have only wished to prevent you from hurrying us into wretchedness without any necessity," said Rosamond, the tears coming again from a softened feeling now that her husband had softened. "It is so very hard to be disgraced here among all the people we know and to live in such a miserable way. I wish I had died with the baby."
She spoke and wept with that gentleness which makes such words and tears omnipotent over a loving-hearted man. Lydgate drew his chair near to hers, and pressed her delicate head against his cheek with his powerful, tender hand. He only caressed her. He did not say anything, for what was there to say? He could not promise to shield her from the dreaded wretchedness, for he could see no sure means of doing so. When he left her to go out again, he told himself that it was 10 times harder for her than for him. He had a life away from home and constant appeals to his activity on behalf of others. He wished to excuse everything in her if he could. But it was inevitable that in that excusing mood he should think of her as if she were an animal of another and feebler species. Nevertheless, she had mastered him.
Chapter 66. Lydgate certainly had good reason to reflect on the service his practice did him in counteracting his personal cares. He had no longer free energy enough for spontaneous research and speculative thinking, but by the bedside of patients, the direct external calls on his judgment and sympathies brought the added impulse needed to draw him out of himself. It was not simply that beneficent harness of routine which enables silly men to live respectably and unhappy men to live calmly. It was a perpetual claim on the immediate fresh application of thought and on the consideration of another's need and trial. Many of us looking back through life would say that the kindest man we have ever known has been a medical man, or perhaps that surgeon whose fine tact, directed by deeply informed perception, has come to us in our need with a more sublime beneficence than that of miracle workers. Some of that twice-blessed mercy was always with Lydgate in his work at the hospital or in private houses, serving better than any opiate to quiet and sustain him under anxieties and his sense of mental degeneracy. Mr. Fairbrother's suspicion as to the opiate was true, however. Under the first galling pressure of foreseen difficulties, and the first perception that his marriage, if it were not to be a yoked loneliness, must be a state of effort to go on loving without too much care about being loved, he had once or twice tried a dose of opium. But he had no hereditary constitutional craving after such transient escapes from the hauntings of misery. He was strong, could drink a great deal of wine, but did not care about it. And when the men round him were drinking spirits, he took sugar and water, having a contemptuous pity even for the earliest stages of excitement from drink. It was the same with gambling. He had looked on at a great deal of gambling in Paris, watching it as if it had been a disease. He was no more tempted by such winning than he was by drink. He had said to himself that the only winning he cared for must be attained by a conscious process of high, difficult combination, tending towards a beneficent result. The power he longed for could not be represented by agitated fingers clutching a heap of coin, or by the half-barbarous, half-idiotic triumph in the eyes of a man who sweeps within his arms the ventures of 20 chapfallen companions. But just as he had tried opium, so his thought now began to turn upon gambling, not with appetite for its excitement, but with a sort of wistful inward gaze after that easy way of getting money, which implied no asking and brought no responsibility. If he had been in London or Paris at that time, it is probable that such thoughts, seconded by opportunity, would have taken him into a gambling house, no longer to watch the gamblers, but to watch them in kindred eagerness. Repugnance would have been surmounted by the immense need to win, if chance would be kind enough to let him. An incident which happened not very long after that airy notion of getting aid from his uncle had been excluded was a strong sign of the effect that might have followed any extant opportunity of gambling. The billiard room at the Green Dragon was the constant resort of a certain set, most of whom, like our acquaintance Mr. Bambridge, were regarded as men of pleasure. It was here that poor Fred Vincey had made part of his memorable debt, having lost money in betting, and had been obliged to borrow of that gay companion. It was generally known in Middlemarch that a good deal of money was lost and won in this way, and the consequent repute of the Green Dragon as a place of dissipation naturally heightened in some quarters the temptation to go there. Probably its regular visitants, like the initiates of Freemasonry, wished that there were something a little more tremendous to keep to themselves concerning it, but they were not a closed community, and many decent seniors as well as juniors occasionally turned into the billiard room to see what was going on. Lydgate, who had the muscular aptitude for billiards and was fond of the game, had once or twice in the early days after his arrival in Middlemarch taken his turn with the queue at the Green Dragon, but afterwards he had no leisure for the game and no inclination for the socialites there. One evening, however, he had occasion to seek Mr. Bambridge at that resort. The horse-dealer had engaged to get him a customer for his remaining good horse, for which Lydgate had determined to substitute a cheap hack, hoping by this reduction of style to get perhaps £20, and he cared now for every small sum as a help towards feeding the patience of his tradesmen. To run up to the billiard room as he was passing would save time. Mr. Bambridge was not yet come, but he would be sure to arrive by and by, said his friend Mr. Horrock, and Lydgate stayed, playing a game for the sake of passing the time. That evening he had the peculiar light in the eyes and the unusual vivacity which had been once noticed in him by Mr. Fairbrother. The exceptional fact of his presence was much noticed in the room, where there was a good deal of Middlemarch company, and several lookers-on, as well as some of the players, were betting with animation. Lydgate was playing well, and felt confident. The bets were dropping round him, and with a swift glancing thought of the probable gain which might double the sum he was saving from his horse, he began to bet on his own play, and won again and again. Mr. Bambridge had come in, but Lydgate did not notice him. He was not only excited with his play, but visions were gleaming on him of going the next day to Brassing, where there was gambling on a grander scale to be had, and where, by one powerful snatch at the devil's bait, he might carry it off without the hook, and buy his rescue from his daily solicitings. He was still winning when two new visitors entered. One of them was a young Hawley, just come from his law studies in town, and the other was Fred Vincey, who had spent several evenings of late at this old haunt of his. Young Hawley, an accomplished billiard player, brought a cool, fresh hand to the cue. But Fred Vincey, startled at seeing Lydgate and astonished to see him betting with an excited air, stood aside and kept out of the circle round the table. Fred had been rewarding resolution by a little laxity of late. He had been working heartily for 6 months at all outdoor occupations under Mr. Garth, and by dint of severe practice had nearly mastered the defects of his handwriting, this practice being perhaps a little the less severe that it was often carried on in the evening at Mr. Garth's, under the eyes of Mary. But the last fortnight Mary had been staying at Lowick Parsonage with the ladies there, during Mr. Fairbrother's residence in Middlemarch, where he was carrying out some parochial plans. And Fred, not seeing anything more agreeable to do, had turned into the Green Dragon, partly to play at billiards, partly to taste the old flavour of discourse about horses, sport, and things in general, considered from a point of view which was not strenuously correct. He had not been out hunting once this season, had had no horse of his own to ride, and had gone from place to place chiefly with Mr. Garth in his gig, or on the sober cob which Mr. Garth could lend him. It was a little too bad, Fred began to think, that he should be kept in the traces with more severity than if he had been a clergyman. "I will tell you what, Mistress Mary, it will be rather harder work to learn surveying and drawing plans than it would have been to write sermons," he had said, wishing her to appreciate what he went through for her sake. "And as to Hercules and Theseus, they were nothing to me. They had sport, and never learned to write a bookkeeping hand." And now, Mary being out of the way for a little while, Fred, like any other strong dog who cannot slip his collar, had pulled up the staple of his chain and made a small escape, not, of course, meaning to go fast or far. There could be no reason why he should not play at billiards, but he was determined not to bet. As to money just now, Fred had in his mind the heroic project of saving almost all of the £80 that Mr. Garth offered him and returning it, which he could easily do by giving up all futile money-spending, since he had a superfluous stock of clothes and no expense in his board. In that way he could in 1 year go a good way towards repaying the £90 of which he had deprived Mrs. Garth, unhappily at a time when she needed that sum more than she did now. Nevertheless, it must be acknowledged that on this evening, which was the fifth of his recent visits to the billiard-room, Fred had not in his pocket, but in his mind, the £10 which he meant to reserve for himself from his half-year's salary, having before him the pleasure of carrying 30 to Mrs. Garth when Mary was likely to be come home again. He had those £10 in his mind as a fund from which he might risk something, if there were a chance of a good bet. Why? Well, when sovereigns were flying about, why shouldn't he catch a few? He would never go far along that road again, but a man likes to assure himself, and men of pleasure generally, what he could do in the way of mischief if he chose, and that if he abstains from making himself ill or beggaring himself or talking with the utmost looseness which the narrow limits of human capacity will allow, it is not because he is a spoony. Fred did not enter into formal reasons, which are a very artificial, inexact way of representing the tingling returns of old habit and the caprices of young blood. But there was lurking in him a prophetic sense that evening that when he began to play, he should also begin to bet, that he should enjoy some punch-drinking, and in general prepare himself for feeling rather seedy in the morning. It is in such indefinable movements that action often begins. But the last thing likely to have entered Fred's expectation was that he should see his brother-in-law Lydgate, of whom he had never quite dropped the old opinion that he was a prig and tremendously conscious of his superiority, looking excited and betting, just as he himself might have done. Fred felt a shock, greater than he could quite account for by the vague knowledge that Lydgate was in debt and that his father had refused to help him, and his own inclination to enter into the play was suddenly checked. It was a strange reversal of attitudes. Fred's blonde face and blue eyes, usually bright and careless, ready to give attention to anything that held out a promise of amusement, looking involuntarily grave and almost embarrassed, as if by the sight of something unfitting, while Lydgate, who had habitually an air of self-possessed strength and a certain meditativeness that seemed to lie behind his most observant attention, was acting, watching, speaking, with that excited, narrow consciousness which reminds one of an animal with fierce eyes and retractile claws. Lydgate, by betting on his own strokes, had won £16. But young Hawley's arrival had changed the poise of things. He made first-rate strokes himself, and began to bet against Lydgate's strokes, the strain of whose nerves was thus changed from simple confidence in his own movements to defying another person's doubt in them. The defiance was more exciting than the confidence, but it was less sure. He continued to bet on his own play, but began often to fail. Still he went on, for his mind was as utterly narrowed into that precipitous crevice of play as if he had been the most ignorant lounger there. Fred observed that Lydgate was losing fast, and found himself in the new situation of puzzling his brains to think of some device by which, without being offensive, he could withdraw Lydgate's attention and perhaps suggest to him a reason for quitting the room. He saw that others were observing Lydgate's strange unlikeness to himself, and it occurred to him that merely to touch his elbow and call him aside for a moment might rouse him from his absorption. He could think of nothing cleverer than the daring improbability of saying that he wanted to see Rosie and wished to know if she were at home this evening. And he was going desperately to carry out this weak device when a waiter came up to him with a message saying that Mr. Fairbrother was below and begged to speak with him. Fred was surprised, not quite comfortably, but sending word that he would be down immediately, he went with a new impulse up to Lydgate, said, "Can I speak to you a moment?" and drew him aside. "Fairbrother has just sent up a message to say he wants to speak to me. He is below. I thought you might like to know he was there, if you had anything to say to him." Fred had simply snatched up this pretext for speaking, because he could not say, "You are losing confoundedly and are making everybody stare at you. You had better come away." But inspiration could hardly have served him better. Lydgate had not before seen that Fred was present, and his sudden appearance with an announcement of Mr. Fairbrother had the effect of a sharp concussion. "No, no," said Lydgate. "I have nothing particular to say to him. But the game is up. I must be going. I came in just to see Bambridge." "Bambridge is over there, but he is making a row. I don't think he is ready for business. Come down with me to Fairbrother. I expect he is going to blow me up, and you will shield," said Fred, with some adroitness. Lydgate felt shame, but could not bear to act as if he felt it by refusing to see Mr. Fairbrother, and he went down. They merely shook hands, however, and spoke of the frost. And when all three had turned into the street, the vicar seemed quite willing to say goodbye to Lydgate. His present purpose was clearly to talk with Fred alone, and he said kindly, "I disturbed you, young gentleman, because I have some pressing business with you. Walk with me to St. Botolph's, will you?" It was a fine night. The sky was thick with stars, and Mr. Fairbrother proposed that they should make a circuit to the old church by the London Road. The next thing he said was, "I thought Lydgate never went to the Green Dragon." "So did I," said Fred. "But he said that he went to see Bambridge." "He was not playing then." Fred had not meant to tell this, but he was obliged now to say, "Yes, he was. But I suppose it was an accidental thing. I have never seen him there before."
You have been going often yourself, then, lately?
Oh, about 5 or 6 times.
I think you had some good reason for giving up the habit of going there.
Yes, you know all about it, said Fred, not liking to be catechized in this way. I made a clean breast to you.
I suppose that gives me a warrant to speak about the matter now. It is understood between us, is it not, that we are on a footing of open friendship? I have listened to you, and you will be willing to listen to me. I may take my turn in talking a little about myself.
I am under the deepest obligation to you, Mr. Fairbrother, said Fred, in a state of uncomfortable surmise.
I will not affect to deny that you are under some obligation to me. But I am going to confess to you, Fred, that I have been tempted to reserve all that by keeping silence with you just now. When somebody said to me, young Vincey has taken to being at the billiard table every night again, he won't bear the curb long, I was tempted to do the opposite of what I am doing, to hold my tongue and wait while you went down the ladder again, betting first and then...
I have not made any bets, said Fred hastily.
Glad to hear it. But I say my prompting was to look on and see you take the wrong turning, wear out Garth's patience, and lose the best opportunity of your life, the opportunity which you made some rather difficult effort to secure. You can guess the feeling which raised that temptation in me. I am sure you know it. I am sure you know that the satisfaction of your affections stands in the way of mine.
There was a pause. Mr. Fairbrother seemed to wait for a recognition of the fact, and the emotion perceptible in the tones of his fine voice gave solemnity to his words. But no feeling could quell Fred's alarm. I could not be expected to give her up, he said, after a moment's hesitation. It was not a case for any pretense of generosity.
Clearly not, when her affection met yours. But relations of this sort, even when they are of long standing, are always liable to change. I can easily conceive that you might act in a way to loosen the tie she feels towards you. It must be remembered that she is only conditionally bound to you, and that in that case another man, who may flatter himself that he has a hold on her regard, might succeed in winning that firm place in her love as well as respect, which you had let slip. I can easily conceive such a result, repeated Mr. Fairbrother emphatically. There is a companionship of ready sympathy which might get the advantage even over the longest associations.
It seemed to Fred that if Mr. Fairbrother had had a beak and talons instead of his very capable tongue, his mode of attack could hardly be more cruel. He had a horrible conviction that behind all this hypothetic statement there was knowledge of some actual change in Mary's feeling. "Of course I know it might easily be all up with me," he said in a troubled voice. "If she is beginning to compare—" He broke off, not liking to betray all he felt, and then said, by the help of a little bitterness, "But I thought you were friendly to me."
"So I am. That is why we are here. But I have had a strong disposition to be otherwise. I have said to myself, if there is a likelihood of that youngster doing himself harm, why should you interfere? Aren't you worth as much as he is? And don't your 16 years over and above his, in which you have gone rather hungry, give you more right to satisfaction than he has? If there's a chance of his going to the dogs, let him. Perhaps you could know how to hinder it, and do you take the benefit?"
There was a pause, in which Fred was seized by a most uncomfortable chill. What was coming next? He dreaded to hear that something had been said to Mary. He felt as if he were listening to a threat rather than a warning. When the vicar began again, there was a change in his tone, like the encouraging transition to a major key.
"But I had once meant better than that, and I am come back to my old intention. I thought that I could hardly secure myself in it better, Fred, than by telling you just what had been going on in me. And now, do you understand me? I want you to make the happiness of her life and your own. And if there is any chance that a word of warning from me may turn aside any risk to the contrary, well, I have uttered it."
There was a drop in the vicar's voice when he spoke the last words. He paused. They were standing on a patch of green where the road diverged towards St. Botolph's, and he put out his hand as if to imply that the conversation was closed. Fred was moved quite newly. Someone highly susceptible to the contemplation of a fine act has said that it produces a sort of regenerating shudder through the frame and makes one feel ready to begin a new life. A good degree of that effect was just then present in Fred Vincey. "I will try to be worthy," he said, breaking off before he could say, "of you as well as of her." And meanwhile, Mr. Fairbrother had gathered the impulse to say something more. "You must not imagine that I believe there is at present any decline in her preference of you, Fred. Set your heart at rest, that if you keep right, other things will keep right." "I shall never forget what you have done," Fred answered. "I can't say anything that seems worth saying. Only I will try that your goodness shall not be thrown away." "That's enough. Goodbye, and God bless you." In that way they parted. But both of them walked about a long while before they went out of the starlight. Much of Fred's rumination might be summed up in the words, "It certainly would have been a fine thing for her to marry Fairbrother. But if she loves me best, and I am a good husband..." Perhaps Mr. Fairbrother's might be concentrated into a single shrug and one little speech. "To think of the part one little woman can play in the life of a man, so that to renounce her may be a very good imitation of heroism, and to win her may be a discipline." Chapter 67. Happily, Lydgate had ended by losing in the billiard room, and brought away no encouragement to make a raid on luck. On the contrary, he felt unmixed disgust with himself the next day, when he had to pay £4 or £5 over and above his gains, and he carried about with him a most unpleasant vision of the figure he had made, not only rubbing elbows with the men at the Green Dragon, but behaving just as they did. A philosopher fallen to betting is hardly distinguishable from a Philistine under the same circumstances. The difference will chiefly be found in his subsequent reflections, and Lydgate chewed a very disagreeable cud in that way. His reason told him how the affair might have been magnified into ruin by a slight change of scenery. If it had been a gambling house that he had turned into, where chance could be clutched with both hands instead of being picked up with thumb and forefinger. Nevertheless, though reason strangled the desire to gamble, there remained the feeling that with an assurance of luck to the needful amount, he would have liked to gamble rather than take the alternative which was beginning to urge itself as inevitable. That alternative was to apply to Mr. Bulstrode. Lydgate had so many times boasted both to himself and others that he was totally independent of Bulstrode, to whose plans he had lent himself solely because they enabled him to carry out his own ideas of professional work and public benefit. He had so constantly in their personal intercourse had his pride sustained by the sense that he was making a good social use of this predominating banker, whose opinions he thought contemptible, and whose motives often seemed to him an absurd mixture of contradictory impressions, that he had been creating for himself strong, ideal obstacles to the proffering of any considerable request to him on his own account. Still, early in March, his affairs were at that pass in which men begin to say that their oaths were delivered in ignorance, and to perceive that the act which they had called impossible to them is becoming manifestly possible. With Dover's ugly security soon to be put in force, with the proceeds of his practice immediately absorbed in paying back debts, and with the chance, if the worst were known, of daily supplies being refused on credit, above all with the vision of Rosamond's hopeless discontent continually haunting him, Lydgate had begun to see that he should inevitably bend himself to ask help from somebody or other. At first, he had considered whether he should write to Mr. Vincey, but on questioning Rosamond, he found that, as he had suspected, She had already applied twice to her father, the last time being since the disappointment from Sir Godwin, and Papa had said that Lydgate must look for himself.
Papa said he had come, with one bad year after another, to trade more and more on borrowed capital, and had had to give up many indulgences. He could not spare a single hundred from the charges of his family. He said, "Let Lydgate ask Bulstrode. They have always been hand in glove."
Indeed, Lydgate himself had come to the conclusion that if he must end by asking for a free loan, his relations with Bulstrode, more at least than with any other man, might take the shape of a claim which was not purely personal. Bulstrode had indirectly helped to cause the failure of his practice, and had also been highly gratified by getting a medical partner in his plans. But who among us ever reduced himself to the sort of dependence in which Lydgate now stood, without trying to believe that he had claims which diminished the humiliation of asking? It was true that of late there had seemed to be a new languor of interest in Bulstrode about the hospital, but his health had got worse, and showed signs of a deep-seated nervous affection. In other respects he did not appear to be changed. He had always been highly polite. But Lydgate had observed in him from the first a marked coldness about his marriage and other private circumstances, a coldness which he had hitherto preferred to any warmth of familiarity between them. He deferred the intention from day to day, his habit of acting on his conclusions being made infirm by his repugnance to every possible conclusion and its subsequent act. He saw Mr. Bulstrode often, but he did not try to use any occasion for his private purpose. At one moment he thought, "I will write a letter. I prefer that to any circuitous talk." At another he thought, "No. If I were talking to him, I could make a retreat before any signs of disinclination." Still the days passed, and no letter was written, no special interview sought. In his shrinking from the humiliation of a dependent attitude towards Bulstrode, he began to familiarise his imagination with another step, even more unlike his remembered self. He began spontaneously to consider whether it would be possible to carry out that puerile notion of Rosamond's which had often made him angry, namely, that they should quit Middlemarch without seeing anything beyond that preface. The question came, would any man buy the practice of me even now for as little as it is worth? Then the sale might happen as a necessary preparation for going away. But against his taking this step, which he still felt to be a contemptible relinquishment of present work, a guilty turning aside from what was a real and might be a widening channel for worthy activity, to start again without any justified destination, there was this obstacle, that the purchaser, if procurable at all, might not be quickly forthcoming. And afterwards? Rosamond in a poor lodging, though in the largest city or most distant town, would not find the life that could save her from gloom, and save him from the reproach of having plunged her into it. For when a man is at the foot of the hill in his fortunes, he may stay a long while there, in spite of professional accomplishment. In the British climate there is no incompatibility between scientific insight and furnished lodgings. The incompatibility is chiefly between scientific ambition and a wife who objects to that kind of residence. But in the midst of his hesitation, opportunity came to decide him. A note from Mr. Bulstrode requested Lydgate to call on him at the bank. A hypochondriacal tendency had shown itself in the banker's constitution of late, and a lack of sleep, which was really only a slight exaggeration of an habitual dyspeptic symptom, had been dwelt on by him as a sign of threatening insanity. He wanted to consult Lydgate without delay on that particular morning, although he had nothing to tell beyond what he had told before. He listened eagerly to what Lydgate had to say in dissipation of his fears, though this too was only repetition. And this moment, in which Bulstrode was receiving a medical opinion with a sense of comfort, seemed to make the communication of a personal need to him easier than it had been in Lydgate's contemplation beforehand. He had been insisting that it would be well for Mr. Bulstrode to relax his attention to business. "One sees how any mental strain, however slight, may affect a delicate frame," said Lydgate, at that stage of the consultation when the remarks tend to pass from the personal to the general. "By the deep stamp which anxiety will make for a time, even on the young and vigorous. I am naturally very strong, yet I have been thoroughly shaken lately by an accumulation of trouble."
I presume that a constitution in the susceptible state in which mine at present is would be especially liable to fall a victim to cholera if it visited our district. And since its appearance near London, we may well besiege the Mercy Seat for our protection, said Mr. Bulstrode, not intending to evade Lydgate's allusion, but really preoccupied with alarms about himself.
You have at all events taken your share in using good practical precautions for the town, and that is the best mode of asking for protection, said Lydgate, with a strong distaste for the broken metaphor and bad logic of the banker's religion, somewhat increased by the apparent deafness of his sympathy. But his mind had taken up its long-prepared movement towards getting help, and was not yet arrested. He added, "The town has done well in the way of cleansing and finding appliances, and I think that if the cholera should come, even our enemies will admit that the arrangements in the hospital are a public good."
"Truly," said Mr. Bulstrode, with some coldness. "With regard to what you say, Mr. Lydgate, about the relaxation of my mental labour, I have for some time been entertaining a purpose to that effect, a purpose of a very decided character. I contemplate at least a temporary withdrawal from the management of much business, whether benevolent or commercial. Also, I think of changing my residence for a time. Probably I shall close or let the Shrubs and take some place near the coast, under advice, of course, as to salubrity. That would be a measure which you would recommend?"
"Oh, yes," said Lydgate, falling backward in his chair with ill-repressed impatience under the banker's pale, earnest eyes and intense preoccupation with himself.
"I have for some time felt that I should open this subject with you in relation to our hospital," continued Bulstrode. "Under the circumstances I have indicated, of course, I must cease to have any personal share in the management, and it is contrary to my views of responsibility to continue a large application of means to an institution which I cannot watch over and to some extent regulate. I shall, therefore, in case of my ultimate decision to leave Middlemarch, consider that I withdraw other support to the new hospital than that which will subsist in the fact that I chiefly supplied the expenses of building it and have contributed further large sums to its successful working."
Lydgate's thought, when Bulstrode paused according to his wont, was, "He has perhaps been losing a good deal of money." This was the most plausible explanation of a speech which had caused rather a startling change in his expectations. He said in reply, "The loss to the hospital can hardly be made up, I fear."
"Hardly," returned Bulstrode, in the same deliberate silvery tone, "except by some changes of plan. The only person who may be certainly counted on as willing to increase her contributions is Mrs. Casaubon. I have had an interview with her on the subject, and I have pointed out to her, as I am about to do to you, that it will be desirable to win a more general support to the new hospital by a change of system."
Another pause, but Lydgate did not speak.
"The change, I mean, is an amalgamation with the infirmary, so that the new hospital shall be regarded as a special addition to the elder institution, having the same directing board. It will be necessary also that the medical management of the two shall be combined. In this way, any difficulty as to the adequate maintenance of our new establishment will be removed. The benevolent interests of the town will cease to be divided."
End of Disc 21.